thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, featuring Tom Scheinfeld, Mills Kelly, and Dan Cohen.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus, episode 54, for April 8th, 2010. Birds in the Background. Well, welcome back to another episode of Digital Campus from the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University. I'm Tom Scheinfeld from foundhistory.org, and I'm here with the regulars, Mills Kelly. Hey, Mills.
How's it going, Tom?
Mills is from edwire.org, of course, and Dan Cohen from dancohen.org. Hi, Dan.
Hey, Tom.
And we're lucky to have with us this week Lisa Spiro from – oh, I'm hearing some birds in the background. Someone –
Yes, my window is open, and there is a bird outside my window.
Oh, isn't happy that pleasant that it's on this beautiful spring day? Oh,
yeah,
well,
it's about 90 degrees here in Fairfax, Virginia, and I was awoken too by birds at around 5:30. It was lovely.
Yeah, that is.
But
nice.
Also annoying.
Well, I'm sorry for the birds interrupting you, Lisa. We're also here with Lisa Spiro from the Rice Digital Media Center. Hi, Lisa.
Hey, Tom.
How's it going?
It's going well. I don't have birds greeting me, though.
No, it's been a little while since we've had you on the show, so I'm glad you're back. Happy to have you back.
Happy to be back.
So, well, I guess it's I think last time I hosted, I was stuck with this story, and I'm stuck with it again. it's unavoidable. The iPad launched over the weekend, in case anybody hadn't heard. It certainly made a big media splash, and the reviews are in. And I would say that, at least from what I've read, on balance, the reviews are positive. It seems like it is a, you know, as expected, Steve Jobs has done a wonderful job with the user interface. The user interactions are seamless. The device is very quick, it looks like it's already creating waves in the consumer electronics and publishing markets. I just saw that Amazon and Sony have both changed the model that they're using for pricing books. They're moving to the Apple, what they call the agent model that Apple has adopted with in its agreement with its publishers, basically allowing publishers a little more control over the price that they charge for books and giving them a little bit larger share of the proceeds. So already making waves in the publishing world. Maybe we could just any new thoughts on the iPad and its relationship to digital humanities and to teaching and learning. Mills, what's your take on it now that we've finally seen the device?
Yeah, of course, I'm still seeing it from a distance. I have not actually gotten my mitts on one, although I'm, you know, Apple, if you're listening, I'm very happy to test it out in my classroom this fall. But I'm still very positive about it, I think, and this goes back to the conversations we've had on the podcast about Kindle when it first came out. And my critique all along is that Kindle was just a much more portable and convenient and less expensive, or at least the textbooks that you would buy on it would be less expensive. It's basically a textbook, and I've never been a fan of textbooks and probably never will be. My main critique was that it was not also an internet-capable device, and I think that the iPad really fills that niche that I've been looking for in the classroom, which is something that is more than an e-reader and either the same as a laptop in terms of its internet capabilities, or even a little bit less is okay with me. But I think that for me, what makes it better than a laptop for the purposes of teaching is that what I'm really interested in is the multimedia capabilities and the, you know, just sort of the interface itself is more immersive and attractive. And so I think it has a lot more possibility to engage students. And I still say I think and possibility because I don't know. The flash issue is going to continue to be a problem for instructors because so much of the video content that we've come to use, especially historical videos through YouTube and other, you know, other websites, not being able to play flash video is just going to be a continuing problem for educators. And I don't know that – I mean, Apple has such a history of being stubborn about these kinds of decisions, so I don't think that they're going to bend on this one. It's going to be interesting to see – which vendors of media content bend the other way. I mean, already several of the TV networks have gone to HTML5 opportunities and or options, but that's going to continue to be a problem. But I'm still very optimistic about the iPad as an iPad and whatever else it spawns in the other market, you know, what Sony comes out with and what other people come out with. I think we're going to see devices that can be really useful in the classroom in the ways that the Kindle isn't and that the laptop isn't.
Yeah, I was actually very pleased to see that several media companies and larger video sharing sites and things had already started out rolling out HTML5 video players that specifically because they want their services to be used on the iPad using H.264 video and HTML5 to deliver it. That to me even that I guess and I don't know whether that's really something that we see from Apple, that encouragement of open standards so frequently, but in this case I think that's a very good thing. You know, Lisa,
well,
I haven't...
of course it's there's a cross cutting here, right? There, in one sense, they're encouraging open standards through the web browser, and then of course what everyone, or not everyone, and I think this is where the interesting part of the story comes in and the rift that this is exposed. But the people who are complaining that the flip side of this is that the dedicated apps are of course on a kind of closed standard through that have to be shipped out through the iTunes store. So it's a weird combination of this. I mean, on the one hand, they are encouraging or attempting to destroy Flash and a kind of proprietary solution for video. And on the other hand, you know, they've got this closed shop going on the other piece. And I think that's what I found interesting about it, especially in the academic world, is that it was amazing to look at the waves of critique and debate on Twitter and the fact that it kind of came down to two camps that I called the sort of hackers versus the artists, or maybe the artists and writers, that there were those who I think had a more deep connection to the computing environment and, you know, what hackers or computer scientists often call the stack, the computer stack, where you get access to the entire computer from the silicon up through various levels of low-level code up through high-level code and then to the interface and have access and control over that entire realm. You lose that on the iPad, of course. But what the writers or artists are excited about is that you gain a lot by losing that access to, I guess, under the hood, that instead the creativity takes place on the surface, actually in this case quite literally of the device. And I think people who were enthralled by the iPad liked the idea that for once you had a device that felt like, you know, a piece of paper, a sort of blank slate, literally, that you could kind of create on top of, and that in some sense wasn't a computer. It wasn't a computational device, but it was some kind of artistic, inspirational device. And I think that was a really interesting debate open up. In some sense, that meta debate is, for me, was more important than, you know, whether you actually like the device or not.
Yeah, it's actually, it seems like it's almost like the reactions to the iPad have to do with kind of your identity and the kind of identity you've sort of constructed for yourself. It was interesting to see that, you know, David Pogue, I think, of the New York Times, in his first review of the iPad, caught on to that too, where he actually wrote two separate reviews, one for what he called the geeks or the techies, and one for everybody else. And the one for the techies, people who, and I think he said, you know, you're a techie if you run Linux, you know, you're a techie if you, you know, various other things. And he said, like, for the techies, you know, it was a fairly negative review. Like, this is not something you're going to really like very much because it doesn't have that, you know, access, as you said, Dan, to the stack. For everyone else, he said, well, if, you know, for everyone else, this is a pretty great device. So it really does, I think, and I think those debates over the iPad, and I think only Apple kind of plays this role in the technology marketplace, that it really has to do with identity, and Apple even gets it. I mean, with its Mac and PC commercials, it's being an Apple consumer is about having a certain identity, and not being an Apple consumer is about having a different identity. And I think that's a very interesting story, and I think it does percolate or filter down to higher ed. Lisa,
Can I just say one more thing on this? I think that the interesting debate was around people our age who – it was amazing how many people trotted out the "I had an Apple II when I was a kid, and that's what I learned to program on." And I had an Apple II when I was a kid, and could open it up. And I remember installing these giant cards in it, and, you know, hooking up this weird external floppy drive when those came out. But, you know, I've tried to point this out on my blog, and I mentioned it at the UVA conference last week. It's actually a historical anomaly that there was a device from Apple that you could do that to. Because actually the original vision at Apple that you can see in their historical archives that are at Stanford was that they always wanted to get rid of all that access. It's not something new that Steve Jobs and his favorite designer, Johnny Ives, have always like had a secret conspiracy to get rid of the computing stack. They've always wanted to do this. It's only that they achieved it in 2010. It's very clear from the start in the original design documents for the Macintosh that they absolutely wanted to hide most of the computing environment to the average user, and that's always been their goal. Sorry to interrupt, Lisa.
Yeah, Lisa. So, how do you feel about this? Are you going to buy one of these things?
Well, you know, if I can talk my husband into the necessity of this device, then I'd love to buy one. But I saw a sort of related critique emerging on Twitter, the debate over whether this was a device really focused on consumption of media or whether it had any possibilities for production as well. And it seems like, I mean, while it's true that there's not a camera that's built into the device, I mean, I can't imagine using with the form factor that it would actually work very well as a camera. And I could see a lot of creative possibilities opening up with the touchscreen interface, with different apps. I mean, already on the iPhone, we see like the brushes application opening up new possibilities for the creation of art. So, I mean, I agree with folks like Matt Kirschenbaum, who on Twitter kind of questioned this binary that was being set up.
Right. I mean, if you're using the brushes application on an iPad, are you not creating? I don't get this point. I mean, I generally respect, you know, intelligent people like Cory Doctorow, who really had a screed about this. But, you know, when you read Cory's piece, and we can link to it from digitalcampus.tv, but, you know, his point is that the only kind, I mean, when you really read through it, is that the only kind of creativity there is on a computer is one where you're coding. And that just strikes me as completely wrong, you know. And I also, you know, did HyperCard and all that stuff. And that's where I informally learned how to program. But there's other kinds of creativity that take place on devices. And it seems to me that the iPod haters are forgetting that there's that kind of creativity. I thought, you know, some of the critiques that talk about, you know, immersive reading, you know, I think immersive reading can also be a form of creativity or engagement that is often forgotten when we just talk about creativity as being writing computer code or having access to computer code.
Well, I would push back a little bit on that, and I don't think it's just computer code. I think you're right that it's text. You know, this is not a great device for. And you know, I know there's a keyboard that can be attached, and I know that there's an on-screen keyboard, and that you know that's serviceable, you know. But this is not a a keyboard device, you know, the device that we've all become very comfortable composing text on. So, I mean, I think that there is, you know, if you are Cory Doctorow and you write novels and blog and long form blog posts and legal briefs, you know, this probably isn't your device. So it's, I don't think it's just code. I think people who sort of see text as their primary vehicle, you know, probably would stick to their laptop or stick to their desktop and large form keyboard. So, I mean, I don't think it's as strict a binary. I agree with that as some people have said, but, you know, I don't think anyone, you know, I wonder how good a note taking device this will be, for instance. Will it really, you know, for classroom use, for instance, will it be good enough to take quick, good notes, or you know, or will people stick to their laptops, or even to their, or even just to their spiral bound notebooks? So I think, you know, we'll see some of those things as the technology gets out there.
And can I just add one thing, and that is that what puppies you all are, because my first device was a Royal Portable manual typewriter.
Oh, very nice.
I totally missed that computer stuff.
Mm. That had a good keyboard feel, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, it was actually a really good workout. You know, your fingers got really strong from the slamming you had to do. However, the only moving parts were the keys and the ribbon, so it didn't tend to break much.
We've been saying we need to do some decorating around CH&M Mills. If you've still got that in your basement, maybe you could bring that in.
Sorry, I gave it up years
sculpture.
Ago.
Right.
I have my Apple II in my basement.
Maybe we should make an old computer.
There could be
gallery.
A good good gallery on that.
Well, all right. Well, that's you know, moving on from the iPad. We're I'm sure we'll revisit this next time and the time after.
When you're host again, Tom. We'll
that'll be my mandate. I'm the iPod correspondent. Okay. Well, so in some other big news, yesterday we saw we're recording this on Wednesday. Yesterday, on Tuesday, we saw that a federal appeals court ruled that the FCC didn't have the power to regulate web traffic under current laws. It essentially was a blow to advocates of net neutrality. The decision, as I understand it, prevents the FCC from telling large cable operators, in this case the plaintiff was Comcast, large cable operators like Comcast, prevents them or it enables them to provide differential traffic on their network. So, for instance, it would allow Comcast to slow down websites that it says are bandwidth hogs. So, for instance, it would allow them to provide slower access to something like YouTube than to another website that wasn't quite so heavy. It would allow them to differentiate between kinds of file types. So if you were downloading video, Comcast might decide to slow that down in favor of people who are downloading email, for instance. So it allows the web service providers, the ISPs, to differentiate between kinds of traffic. And you know, this is a fairly complicated issue, and I'm sure I haven't explained it very well, but I think it does have some implications for higher education and for cultural heritage, not least that, you know, if the ISPs are now if this decision holds, will be free to decide, you know, what comes through their networks and what doesn't, or at least they'll be able to prefer certain kinds of content over others. And one scenario is that they will prefer their own content. For instance, Comcast just bought NBC. They may prefer NBC content to, for instance, you know, content from the Museum of Modern Art or something else. They may prefer their own content. They may also prefer content of paid partners. So theoretically under this ruling, they could ask a website like YouTube to pay a fee to have preferential delivery of their content. Allowing these ISPs to make decisions on what comes through and what doesn't, I think has some implications for us. Lisa, you've been, I think, following this a little bit. What's your take on this latest decision and on net neutrality and this issue of net neutrality in general?
I think this is a worrisome development. I mean, if you're a proponent of open education, of the ability of the citizenry to have access to educational materials, I mean, I think core to that is this idea of creative commons of available content, but also of open being able to openly access that content sort of via the network. And you don't want preferential treatment being given to certain providers of content. I think that can kind of undermine the whole principle of kind of building knowledge through not giving preferential treatment to a particular kind of content. It does seem like, you know, there are possible ways to respond to this decision. As I understand it, it was a pretty narrow decision that said that the FCC doesn't have the ability to regulate the broadband providers, but possible ways of approaching this are that the FCC could assert its rights to regulate under what Title II, which allows it to regulate the telecommunications industry. Another possibility, which is certainly more long-term, is that Congress could step in and explicitly give the FCC this authority.
Right. Right. Yeah, Dan, you were going to say.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems like we're drifting into really difficult territory here, I think, in general, in terms of these kinds of services, at least in the United States. I mean, I'd be interested to hear from our international audience where there is greater governmental control over what is effectively cyber infrastructure. And as cyber infrastructure becomes increasingly important for education, you know, these things become really tricky. You know, in the U.S., we rely on AT&T and Verizon and Comcast to kind of build out infrastructure, but then that infrastructure becomes so critical to many parts of the economy, including education, that, you know, obviously there's a governmental interest in control. And, you know, I think this nuclear option that as it's been called, that Lisa brought up about sort of redeclaring broadband into a different section of FCC control effectively means that, you know, they move it into a category that's sort of like running water.
Right.
I mean, that's effectively what it is, that the government says, you know what, these pipes are so important that we're going to control them a little bit more tightly. And my sense is then what happens, again, in the kind of American environment is then the private corporations say, well, then we're not going to spend the $8 billion to build out, you know, rural broadband infrastructure because, you know, we're being so tightly controlled by the government that we'll lose the profit margin on this because under this different titling, they can do price controls on it. They can sort of do particular mandates. And it just strikes me that you know, it's just a really difficult realm of control and access. And, you know, of course, the other side of this, but before the audience thinks I'm being libertarian about it, is that, you know, the complaints by the AT&Ts and the Verizons and the Comcast in this country remind me a lot of Matt Groening, who created The Simpsons, but before that was a terrific cartoonist who did the Life in Hell comic strip. And he had this great comic strip that it reminds me of where this is back in the age of cassette tapes. And he had this comic strip about cassette tapes and piracy of music. And it was entitled, you know, do cassette tapes hurt the recording industry? And the answer was, yes, instead of making billions and billions, now they only make billions. And it strikes me that that's a lot of what's going on here, is that there's such incredible optimization of profits in this industry. You know, AT&T, at the same time, they're complaining about this. They're making iPhone owners pay $150 to buy little microcells for their offices or homes because AT&T's service is so bad. And they're making the customers pay for this, and then they're making money off of that. So I just think how to break down who's paying for this infrastructure and what the access controls on it are is going to be a real struggle over the next, you know, 3 to 5 years.
Well, this is a problem in the industry in general, where they you know, the company like Comcast doesn't want to be regulated, but they also enjoy a near monopoly in many of their markets. I know where I live in Washington, D.C., you know, Verizon hasn't brought Fios to Washington, D.C. If I want high-speed internet access, Comcast is my only option. You know, I am completely dependent on Comcast for what I view as a utility, right? Like, I need the internet about as much as I need running water in my house. I could last a little longer without internet, but I after a couple of weeks, I probably couldn't do my job without internet in my house, and being completely dependent on Comcast is a really problematic situation. And when they're the only game in town, I don't really have another option. So they don't want to be regulated, but they also don't want to. They also enjoy this government sanctioned monopoly.
There's a root issue that, and this is where I will be interested to hear what some of our international audience has to say, where the circumstances are different. The access to the internet in the United States is not defined as a public good, the way that access to clean drinking water is defined, or electricity is defined as a public good. And so what we've done is, instead of had municipalities build out the electrification system or build out the drinking water system, we've had corporations build out the internet system based on existing business models. They were either already installing cable or they were already providing telephone service. And so it was businesses in other industries were asked to do this. And, the premise of the cable monopoly is that it was going to be extraordinarily expensive to install all that cable. And so they should have a monopoly to reap the benefit of that for some number of years. But access to cable television is not a public good. It's a luxury. And we assumed when the internet went up that it was like cable. It was a luxury. And now it's become so essential to the functioning of the economy that I think that we're going to have a real debate over the next few years about whether internet access is a public good or not. And this was really brought home to me a couple weeks ago. I was out at Kansas State University, and I can't remember the last time I was on a big university campus that was completely – where the network was completely open. And it was just so much better, because Kansas State has defined internet access in their immediate neighborhood in Manhattan, Kansas, as a public good. And so anybody can access their network. And so,
that's incredible. It's been years since I've seen that as well. I mean,
yeah. They all have authentic. When was the last time any of us saw a completely open campus network? And,
yeah.
Because when I got there, I said, I'm going to need to access the wireless. What, can you give me a password? And they said, no. And I said, you can't? And they said, no, because you don't actually need one here. It's okay. You're in a free zone. And but I think this really is the issue, is the root issue, is that we haven't defined internet access as a public good. And I think initially for good reasons, because we didn't know what the internet was going to be. And so phone companies and cable providers said, we'll help with that. And we need to make money on it, of course, because we have stockholders. Fine. But we're right at this sort of, I hate to use the term tipping point, this moment where we have to decide whether high-speed broadband access is an essential infrastructure the way that electrification and water and sewer are essential infrastructures or not.
I was listening over the weekend to the latest In Our Time podcast from the BBC, and they were the panel was discussing the history of urbanization in the 19th century, and they were looking at Victorian London and looking at sort of in the mid to late 19th century, how London's sort of essential city infrastructure was all operated by private companies. So there were 10 different water companies and 10 different fire engine companies and 10 different or more railroad companies, and that gradually over the course of the mid to late 19th century, all of that was municipalized. All of that was brought under the municipal government. And I think there's a parallel there, and that we may be at a certain point we may see that this telecommunications infrastructure municipalized in that way, or at least I think, at least from where I'm sitting in Washington, D.C., I hope so. Moving on to something more at least immediately related to digital humanities and cultural heritage. The Office of Digital Humanities at the National Endowment for the Humanities released last week its latest list of digital humanities startup grants winners, and it's an interesting list. It's an impressive list. This year, this time around, the competition was incredibly fierce. I think there were 15 or 16 winners, and more than 200 applicants. So we're talking about very stiff competition. It just shows the kind of creativity that's going on in this space. And I think the grantees are representative of that. Mills, you recently posted something on Ed Wired looking at the kind of breakdown of the kinds of projects that NEH funded this time around. What did you find there?
Well, you know, I'm with you. I think that's a very impressive list of projects and a really interesting list also. And every time the announcement comes out, for me, it's always kind of an exciting moment because it gives me a sense for what people in the wider digital humanities community are thinking about and trying to push the envelope on a little bit. And so it's kind of like being on a search committee and seeing what all the young scholars are working on with their dissertations. It keeps you updated on the field. I noticed sort of three things when I looked at the list. One was that I kind of wonder what happened to Web 2.0, because with the exception of a project that we had funded at the Center for History and New Media, our colleague Sharon Leon's the lead person on that, and one other project. Those are the only two out of this large group of impressive projects that might be seen as sort of intrinsically Web 2.0 focused projects. And so the question I had was whether, you know, Web 2.0 is falling out of fashion among academic techies. Were the proposals that were submitted that were Web 2.0 like just not very good? Why that was, because just as recently as 2 years ago, that's all we wanted to talk about in digital humanities was how Web 2.0 was going to revolutionize everything we're doing. And if the startup grants represent something like a cutting edge among academic tech types in the humanities, then I wonder what happened to Web 2.0 there. The second is how few use some kind of handheld computing platform. There were a couple, but this bothered me more, and because this is something we've talked about a lot on the podcast, that we think that all three of us think, and Lisa, I don't want to speak for you.
I agree.
So, I mean, it's just something that it seems like most of the people we talk to a lot think that the handheld computing device, the smartphone, whatever it is really going to revolutionize the humanities. And there just wasn't a lot in this list of projects that reflected that. And so, again, I wonder, are people just not submitting their proposals, you know, or the proposals that were submitted not very good or whatever? I was not on a panel this time. I've been on panels before. I wasn't on one of the review panels this time around, so I can't speak with any authority, so I'm only questioning. And then finally, the thing that I'm kind of dubious about is what seemed to be the popularity of proposals, projects that are going to do sort of 3D things. That seemed like the next big thing, at least as reading the tea leaves of what was awarded.
Influence of Avatar.
It could be the influence of Avatar. It could be the, you know, the continuing fascination with, you know, these virtual worlds. And, you know, all of a sudden I can't even think of the one that we like to slam on so much. It's so far from my mind. Linden Labs. Thank you very much. See, it's like I can't even remember the name Second Life anymore. Either that or it's just because, well, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, my first computer was a manual typewriter. So draw your own conclusions. But I'm not sure that 3D is what's going to really make a big difference in the humanities. And so I'll be really interested to see what these projects turn out at the other end, because I'd like to be convinced, but I'm call me a skeptic on 3D. So that's kind of where that was my reading of these from a distance.
Lisa, what do you think of those sort of, if we just sort of take those three categories that Mills lays out, Web 2.0, 3D and mobile. Where do you see those three things? How do you see those three things playing out in the kind of, you know, near future of digital humanities and digital cultural heritage? Where do you see those things? You see some on the rise as Mills does, and some falling away, or do you see them all as continuing? Where do you see this going?
You know, I actually see all three really continuing to be on the rise. I mean, there are only 18 projects funded, so, you know, roughly, 20% of the projects were mobile focused. More like a third were focused on 3D. I don't know what broad conclusions you can draw from that, but. It does seem that, you know, there are a lot of projects that are looking at crowdsourcing as a way of providing and annotating content in the digital humanities. I know that, you know, Virginia in particular has been doing a lot of work on 3D modeling as a way of documenting cultural heritage and piecing together broken artifacts. And I think that is, you know, interesting work. It's not work that I've done myself, but I can see real applications of that. Mobiles, given our conversation today and general trends, I mean, I think that is going to be hugely important. And I wonder if it's a problem of a lot of digital humanities shops not possessing the expertise to do that kind of work, or not having current models where scholarly work, uses mobile approaches. I'm not sure what the holdup is there.
Yeah, I agree. I sort of see that, not just in this latest group of grant proposals, but I sort of agree, Mills, that we haven't seen a ton of mobile out of our field yet. I think there have been some good experiments and there are some decent models, and I know there are some things in the works.
Do you think it has something to do with the fragmentation of mobile?
Right.
And also the difficulty of open sourcing stuff. I mean, if funders are generally requiring you to open source your code, I mean, this is kind of a question. I mean, will they take an iPad app proposal, for
right.
instance?
Well, that's a good question. Like, I've sort of thought about that too. Will NEH, which in the ODH grant guidelines mandates, you know, open sourcing of the technology, that's part of one of the requirements now. I suppose you can open source the code for the, you know, you can release the Objective-C code and the Cocoa interface for the application, but those languages, of course, are not open source. I suppose there's maybe a way to thread that needle, but I do think the fragmentation is a problem. I mean, do you build a mobile web app? Do you build an Android app and an iPhone app and a BlackBerry app? I think that is I think that remains a problem. I also think that, you know, I mean, my personal take on this is, you know, humanities has not been something that we do on the move. We travel a lot and we go places, but it's not the immediate applications, I don't think, are clear. I mean, I think we can do things with mapping and, you know, you're in a historic environment and you're, you know, receiving content based on location-based services. And I think there are some ideas out there, but I think we don't have sort of easy models in our existing practice that sort of translate to these mobile platforms. Interesting to see where that will go and where Web 2.0 and 3D will go.
Can I just say one word on the Web 2.0, because I thought Mills was absolutely spot on that, is that at the same time there was this announcement this month that JISC, which is the UK sort of NEH and other things, but they do a lot of digitization funding. And excuse me, they actually had a grant program specifically for crowdsourced content. And they announced the first five winners of those grants early April, as we're writing. Actually, I think it was today, April 7th, that we're recording. And they're expecting to do another slate, I think, of five in late April. And these range from we can link to this again from digitalcampus.tv, but these range from everything from using the public to transcribe old meteorological data, to local history contributions, to a kind of this flood information network that will look at the history of local flooding by talking to and getting a digital archive from people in the Severn community. So, I mean, there's some very interesting proposals in that JISC in the UK that I think form an interesting contrast to the NEH Award. So just something to keep an eye on, that it's interesting to look around at different programs. I thought it was interesting that JISC actually had a specific call for proposals for what they called community content, which is effectively crowdsourcing from the community.
Yeah, well, we'll definitely link to those, as you said, Dan. You know, another sort of social networking crowdsourcing story, I think, is this the recent UVA Shape conference, Shape of Things to Come conference, Dan, that you were at, where I think Twitter played a large and maybe a slightly unexpected role in the proceedings with sort of large number of people participating in the conference discussion via Twitter remotely, who weren't actually able to make the conference in Charlottesville. What was that UVA Shape conference, Dan, and what can you tell us about Twitter and the kinds of things the role that played there?
Yeah, well, it was a very interesting conference. I think if you're listening to this podcast in April 2010, it's probably worth checking out the hashtag, which should still be available through search.twitter.com, and the hashtag was #UVAShape, all one word. You can get a sense, if you can go reverse chronological, get a sense of what was discussed. It was actually, I think, the best Twitter back channel of any conference. And I think in part that was because there was a decision among the people who were actually at the conference early on, a sort of informal decision, that we do a little bit less of the tweeting what the panel was saying or what the a particular speaker was saying at the moment, and more throwing out questions and debate around what was going on at the conference. And in that way, it really, I think, engaged people who were not at the conference. So I think it's something that I'm certainly going to try to do, because I think I hadn't thought about that mode of Twitter back channel. Generally, when I've gone to conferences, especially when I feel like a lot of my followers are not at the conference and might want to know what's going on, I've tended to kind of throw out interesting quotes or links. But in some ways, having the Twitter back channel be, you know, a discussion in and of itself, rather than just a reflection of what's going on, might be a better way to handle tweeting at academic conferences. But just to rewind and just briefly, the conference was called The Shape of Things to Come, and it was a 2.5-day conference at UVA that really revolved around what the organizers called editorial projects. So these were digital humanities projects that involved collections and sort of editorial content. In other words, the digital equivalents of what would have been a, you know, Papers of X, Papers of George Washington Project, or a, let's say, an Encyclopedia of Civil War Washington. Now, in 2010, a lot of these things are websites. So we looked at, for instance, CivilWarDC.org, which is a project by Ken Price at University of Nebraska and some of his colleagues to kind of talk about Washington in the Civil War era, including primary source documents, including contextualization. And so there were other documentary editors there, the head of the Dolly Madison Papers, some publishers were there, representing university presses mostly, who often work on these kind of editorial projects. And then there were, you know, what I often call the usual suspects, some of our fellow travelers who've been working in digital humanities for a long time. But what I thought, John Unsworth had a terrific point, because, you know, the two of us have been at a lot of these conferences with the same people. But I think he made a great point that there was another group there that kind of made this a fascinating mixture of people. And that was, there were a lot of, you know, what I would normally call analog or traditional scholars who, now are suddenly kind of finding uses for the digital, actually in many ways in Web 2.0 ways, who I had never met before at these conferences. So for instance, there was a group of papyrologists at the conference who are people at an advanced stage in their academic career and suddenly have discovered that, you know, as they digitize their core collection, so papyri that are at various archives, and then they're sharing this across a network. So one of the most impressive projects that I found was a project called, that I never heard of before, was called the Integrated Digital Papyrology Project. And it was really just a kind of decentralized network of scholars in papyrology who were exchanging high-quality scans by using standard metadata and file exchange protocols. And they had created effectively a really nice Web 2.0 project with not a lot of technology. I mean, if you actually go to the website for this, you'll see it's it's not really beautifully designed, but and it's got a lot of, it's very text heavy. It's all the things that I would critique in my digital history class if we were on the week on web design. But it's really effective for their community. There was a community of, classicists who, you know, I've always seen Greg Crane, who's been running the Perseus Project for 2 decades at Tufts and is a leading person in digital humanities. But there was Greg's dissertation director from Harvard.
Yeah, I was. Professor Nash was there, and I was like, and it was.
Gregory
Nash. I mean, I had him as an undergraduate. I was thinking, like, he's not what you would think in the digital vanguard.
Right, exactly. But you know, he's suddenly interested in this stuff. So I thought that was a really good point that John Unsworth made, that the topics may have been the same, but the people changed, and basically the discussion revolved around the ways in which we can not only create these kinds of editorial projects online, but also sustain and publish them. And I think a lot of the discussion revolved around questions about sustainability, which was really broadly construed. It was financial stability, but it was also community stability, how these projects kind of make their way into communities like papyrologists, many of whom are not very technically sophisticated, but who are now engaged with this project, and what that kind of, I guess, buy-in, if we want to use marketing terms, how that buy-in happens and then how that leads to potential sustainable models. So there's a lot of discussion around that. And you know, I think that the proceedings are going to come out, I think, by the end of this month, April 2010. It's going to be in print on demand, but also online for free. And the people who gave talks or the panelists all wrote position papers, which I wish were open access from the start. I think because of the nature of the crowd, there was a little bit more concern about everyone perfecting their pieces. So I think people are still fine-tuning their pieces. But they'll all be available as well at shapeofthings.org, I think, in the very near future. So it's worth, I think, for this audience, worth really taking a look at.
And the word is that the Twitter stream may also be included in the proceedings.
Right. Well, this is also the first academic conference that I've been at that had a court reporter taking down every single word. And everyone was actually fascinated by the technology of the court reporter, who was using one of those 10-key input devices and also recording it, all the audio of it, so she could go back and correct any of the words. And so we'll have the entire conference, every single word said at the conference. And then Jerry McGann, who was the lead organizer for it at UVA, made a decision at the end that the Twitter stream was so good and there was so much pressure, I think, by those who were tweeting, that he would also include the Twitter stream, which would be really interesting to match up also with the court reporter stream to get a sense of what was going on real time. So I think some very innovative ways of covering the conference as well. So well worth checking out in all of its guises.
Lisa, I think you were following the Twitter stream. What was your sort of experience? So that's Dan's experience from, you know, being there. What's your experience sort of from pulling it from the Twitter stream?
Well, I think Steve Ramsey played an important role in the Twitter stream from afar, sort of the grumpy uncle questioning whether, you know, the old conversations were being rehashed at this conference about the value of the digital humanities and so forth. But it, from the responses I saw from the people who were at the conference, it did seem like that you know, new directions were being pursued in the conversations, perhaps in part because of the presence of you know, more quote unquote traditional scholars there.
I mean, I think, Dan, the definitely the Twitter stream in itself, and I was following it as well, was interesting, and you know, and as Lisa said, like, Steve Ramsey was raising important questions, I think challenging questions, to the participants. One question I have is, how much did the Twitter stream affect the discussions in the room? I mean, I know that you know, the Twitter stream sort of stands alone as its own important event. I think that the people who were, you know, like you, tweeting, were engaged in that discussion. But the people who weren't, I mean, were they aware that this was going on? Were their you know, positions affected by what was being said, and the discussion, the larger discussion, affected by what was being said on Twitter?
Yeah, well, I mean, there were several times where people got up, Matt Kirschenbaum was one of them, and actually read from the Twitter stream, and then people discussed what was going on there. Or there was another case where several of us were sort of working out a you know, perhaps half-baked theory about digital projects and their relationships to academic disciplines, and that sort of took place on Twitter and then also over coffee for those who weren't on Twitter. And then, you know, and then that conclusion was sort of presented during one of the panels. So I do think it had an effect. I mean, it's still, we're at a time where, and particularly the group that was at UVA, I think it was probably 25% on Twitter. It was my sense from, I think John Unsworth in one of the sessions stood in the back and sort of looked out and said, you know, said he saw a bunch of tweet decks, but it was still really a minority. So, there is that question of, you know, technological penetration and how many people were on Twitter, but I do think it had some effect. You know, I have to say, I won't name the meetings, but I've been to other pretty similar meetings where there was some pretty serious antagonism toward those who were tweeting, because they felt, I think the people who were not on Twitter felt like it was opening up a discussion that they wanted closed, because they felt safer if they could just speak openly in private and not have someone tweet about what they were saying. So I think, and there was actually some discussion about that over coffee. So I think it kind of depends on the kind of conference and the mixture of people about what the comfort level is with bringing the Twitter stream actually into the discussion.
And, you know, just before we move along, you know, you mentioned that that sustainability was one of the big topics. Do you have the answer for us? Did you guys come up with the answer to that question?
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't think we made a lot of progress on that. I think, you know, the models that were there were, you know, effectively having institutional buy-in, so having... There was some progress on them. Let me say that. I think Jerry made a terrific point that I tried to make in my position piece, but very poorly. But Jerry McGann made this great point that sustainability is not about the what, it's about the who. And that sustaining digital projects requires a certain group of people to exist and to be funded in perpetuity. And so, frankly, Tom, that's people like you and other people that we work with here at the center, who are in kind of, you know, I think what's been called alternative academic careers.
Right.
And both Jerry and I were making a strong push in our papers for finding ways to fund these people, because they really are the people that often are the project directors. So models where those people are in, let's say, a library line that's permanently funded, or an archive line, or a museum line, or are funded off of various streams, I think became very critical. And I think so people listening to the podcast should definitely take a look at Jerry McGann's piece, where he talks about, he has actually two sections of his paper on the not the what, but the who. And I think that was a really great point.
Yeah, I think that's an important shift, because I think, you know, we... Digital humanities, I think, from the very beginning, or at least from the certainly from the beginning of my time in it, has been very project focused, and You know, it's been project focused in its funding, and it's been project focused in its staffing. And I recently wrote a blog post where I tried to say some of this as well. Like, we have to get past this idea of project funding and get more towards a model of organizational funding and sustainable staff funding. So that's
right. Well, and it was clear they do that a little bit better. Jeffrey Rockwell, who was at the conference, who is at the University of Alberta, and he talked about the Canadian model, where there's really major funding. And first of all, I mean, a lot of this does come down to money, of course, and there's more substantial funding, for instance, for consortia of universities working in a particular area, let's say history of the ecology, and Bill Turkell's group and his network called Niche, which I think we've talked about on the podcast before, where Shirk gave them funding to kind of create a large group of academics working in a particular area, at the environment, the ecology, and the history of that. And it gives them a kind of home to do that, but the funding levels are so much higher. I mean, I do encourage people to read my piece as well, which I will also try to blog so that it's out there more openly. But my piece, which I think was a little bit more ornery than Jerry McGann's piece, got at your point, I think, as well, Tom, about project funding, where you know, I think we are running into a problem in the United States where there is effectively venture capital funding for starting up, and in fact NEH calls it that, as we've just discussed, startup funding, but not a lot of guidance about how to sustain these things, and really no funding for sustainable models. And I think my thinking now, although again it might be a little half-baked, is my short version of it is what I call all or nothing. That there, I think digital humanities projects can succeed either at the very low end of sustainable models, where there's almost zero funding provided, so everything that relates to the project is sort of gift labor. A lot of professors or librarians working as, you know, sort of part-time on a project, I think that works well. I think Ken Price's Civil War Washington project is that way. It's a, sort of a labor of love, and that's a great model, because once you start getting into needing, let's say, a half-time webmaster, well, then you got to worry about how you come up with $20,000 or $30,000 a year, and that's really hard for projects, especially esoteric topics. Not that Civil War Washington is an esoteric project, but let's say Acadian or some of the ancient world projects that were going on don't have stakeholders that would invest that kind of money year to year. So that's one end. And then there's the all part of it, where there are projects, and indeed I have to say there are some here at the center that do require ongoing, very substantial 5, 6, sometimes 7-figure a year funding. And those are another piece that I think we need to figure out how those get funded. And of course that brings up the tension between, you know, the subscriber model and the open access model. Because, of course, once you're in that realm of needing substantial funding on a year-to-year basis, I think the obvious solution is a subscriber model, where you say, okay, well, this resource is closed except to subscribing universities, and those universities pay X thousands of dollars a year, and that's how we fund it, which it totally makes sense as a business model, but it runs into this problem that I think was getting discussed at the Shape of Things meeting, that, well, when you do that, then you lose the kind of ethical obligation to open up academic resources to a much broader audience.
Right, it runs counter to
To the sustainability model. So yeah. I think there's still a lot more work to be done on that front.
Well, it is a big issue, and I think we're gonna be talking about it a lot more on this podcast as well. Just in one final story here, still on the theme of sustainability, I think in another area of academic computing, we've seen as one sustainability model on campuses is outsourcing of some of the kind of core technology services functions of the university, in particular email, where we've seen lots of universities move to Google Apps for email services and other cloud-based email service providers to handle all of their email. And we've seen that at universities on this continent, in Europe, and elsewhere. But this week, or last week, I guess, we saw that Yale, which had been planning for a while now to make this switch, to move to Google Apps and Gmail for its email provision, has put that project on hold due to faculty and administration concerns. They sort of right before they were about to make this switch, they put it to a university-wide review process, and several concerns were raised about Google and the Google the Google Apps suite. You know, I think those, according to the article in the Yale Daily News that I read, that there were several reservations expressed that fell into three categories. One is the kind of the technological risks, privacy risks, and downsides. One is with the transfer of the information from the sort of uptime of the services, and one category were ideological issues, worries about Google and its operation in the marketplace, its position in China and other emerging economies and let's say less than free economies, and so this is a little bit of pushback on this, you know, sort of wave of moving towards cloud services, outsourcing of central IT functions to commercial companies. Mills, what you've been following these moves, what do you and from your position as an administrator in the university, how do you see Yale's backtracking on this?
I see it as kind of idiosyncratic, in the sense that I don't think that the Yale decision has any big implications for other institutions. I mean, Yale has sort of a long history of making decisions about things on campus, whether it was how teaching assistants were going to be compensated for their work or other things that are very sort of inwardly focused and specific to that community. So I sort of don't see it as having much bigger implications immediately, but I do think it does, and then I'll contradict myself and say, I do think it means that it's an expression of some anxiety about moving to the cloud on campuses. And what I don't know, even after reading the stories about the Yale decision, is the degree to which this was driven by sort of consumer anxiety, meaning faculty and students, or sort of wholesaler anxiety, meaning the central IT folks. I just can't get a good read on that aspect of the decision. But I think that it can't really be driven that much by student anxiety, because so many of our students just live, you know, their documents are all living there in the cloud anyway, or they just don't think about it much, about security of email or whatever it might be. I think there are legitimate concerns for people who are doing research that is funded under specific security provisions, whether it's, you know, sort of national defense kind of stuff, or security provisions about personal data in the psychology department or something like that. I think that, you know, the it's legitimate to be concerned about those things, but at the same time, you know, living here in the DC area, you hear these ads all the time now for various providers, you know, trying to sell their services to government agencies to move their data into the cloud. And if they wouldn't even be advertising that as a possibility if the U.S. government hadn't already approved that kind of a shift. And so while I'm sure that the National Security Administration is not parking data in the cloud, or at least I hope they're not, plenty of other government agencies either are or are anticipating doing it. So I think there's a legitimate tension there, legitimate concern about the degree to which information is secure. The question about, you know, worrying about Google's corporate practices, well, that's also a legitimate concern, but that's a whole separate issue from the concern about security. And so I have a hard time parsing it out. And I think that most campuses, I still think that sort of the big elite universities or the very well-funded and popular universities, they in some ways get a little too much attention in these kinds of discussions because they represent such a tiny slice of American higher education. You know, they're high profile, and what happens at Harvard or what happens at Yale or what happens at the University of Michigan, you know, it matters in some ways, but they're such a tiny minority of American higher education when, you know, the Cleveland States and the University of Missouri, ROLA, and all these other schools that educate, you know, hundreds of millions of students, they're making decisions based much more on sort of how can we do this in an efficient and cost-effective manner, and will it be good enough? And so I think the good enough principle is going to apply to these kinds of shifts away from proprietary from sort of locally based stuff to cloud based computing. So that's sort of my view on it, is that yes, okay, so Yale made this decision, but I don't think it in the long term shift toward the cloud, I don't think it's going to make much of a difference.
Lisa, do you see this the same way? Do you see it as sort of an idiosyncratic elite university decision, or do you see this as reflective of broader concerns about, well, Google in particular and its corporate practices and its position in the marketplace and frankly its security in the wake of the breaches that occurred in China?
Right. Well, I'm on a listserv that includes a lot of campus IT directors, and this has been a major issue of discussion from people, you know, at liberal arts colleges and state universities and so forth. So it does seem to be an issue that cuts across the campus community, and it seems like the fundamental issue is one of trust. Can we really trust a corporation with private data? And there's been a lot of back and forth about whether, you know, the kinds of corporate policies that Google subscribes to, and whether locally held campus data is any more secure. But I do think these security and privacy issues are of concern broadly.
Right. I would agree with that there is some concern about this, and I think we haven't seen the end of this. I think we're there's going to be more bums in the road in this transition to these cloud services, and I think we're going to see that we're going to see that more and more. Well, we've used up our time and then some. I want to thank you, Lisa, for joining us this time around. We got to get you back soon. Thanks very much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for the invite.
That's great.
Yeah,
great.
Thanks, Lisa.
Great having you. And Mills and Dan, I guess I'll be talking to you again in a couple of weeks for the next edition of Digital Campus.
The thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.